action of kicking the book, and this is the real sound. It's the actual sound that's occurring on set. I'm thinking about having listened to you talk about the creation of the wind within the set, that the special piping was created to bring the wind without bringing the mechanical sound that's creating the wind. The air of the wind is still going to, I would think, make some noise over the microphones as the air passes by. Is that something you're trying to further control, or is having that along with the vocal giving a degree of authenticity because it's giving the listener the sound of what they're seeing?
There's a couple of things. It's a re again such it's so nice talking to you guys, because you're fellow sound people, and I recognize it's you're asking all the right questions. So silent wind is a new thing on movie sets. It's something that we developed specifically because I couldn't bear, as a production sound mixer, that every time we were shooting blue screen, and in other words, we're blue screen shooting interior sound stage, but in the cinema, what you're going to see is an exterior set built in VFX. Now, we didn't do that a lot on Wicked because Nathan Crowley, as I'm sure you know, built these huge, enormous worlds for us to work in, which were really outside. But obviously, on something like Defying Gravity, where Cynthia's flying through the air on a broomstick, we have to do that blue screen. So that was one of the big scenes where we were required to use silent wind. And Paul Corbould, our special effects supervisor, had a number of different options. I've worked with him many times, and he built some great options for me for silent wind. Now, one thing that I know that, again, I shouldn't be trying to negotiate on a movie set is the level of wind. Because, again, if I start trying to ask the director and the director of photography to prioritize my vocal above the visual element, I could potentially drag the audience out of the story. Because although the vocal sounds great because there's no wind on it, you're saying, well, look, Cynthia doesn't look like she's flying because there isn't enough wind in her hair or in her costume or in her cape. And so that's a negotiation that is very, very delicate, and I need to be careful how hard I push. And so what I would say that I do is I work very hard with special effects to get rid of that mechanical noise and to get it off the set. But what I don't say is, can we reduce the amount of wind, because it's killing me. It's killing the vocal. What I will do is I will say to the special effects technician who's holding that tube, you can get 6 foot closer to Cynthia. And if you can get six foot closer to Cynthia, that's going to get your wind jet closer, so we can bring down the level of the machinery and how hard it's pushing that wind out of the nozzle. But essentially, I'm still getting the same level of wind on the costume. It's just not being created in such a noisy manner. So I've still got this wind hitting the microphone. And what we do with that is exactly what we've done for years and years in the film industry with personal mics, which is when we're on an exterior and there is real wind blowing, we have to put a furry cover over it. And the way that we use furry covers and the levels that we use furry covers is kind of like the experience of being a sound mixer. And I know instantly if I put my head in front of a silent wind jet, or I stand on a football field and feel the wind, I know which one of the five different levels of furry cover I should use. Because obviously, the heavier the fur, the less top end I have in the vocal. I start to rob the vocal of top end. And so I need to be very, very careful not to overdo the level of fur across the pickup lobe of the mic. And although you say, do we hear the wind going across the mic? We don't. But what we would do is, if the fur wasn't deep enough, we would just hear the microphone popping. We would just hear it struggling with low end. If I've used the right fur, this is the noise that I get from silent wind. It's just a very, it's a top end, and it's above where the human vocal is, so that I know that Nancy can remove that afterwards by homing in on that frequency without damaging the vocal in any way. And the other thing is that I know that the score is going to hide that anyway, because although I've got a shh underneath the vocal, let's say the vocal is peaking here and the silent wind noise is there, I know that the orchestra is going to be here. And so I also know that Nancy isn't going to have to aggressively remove that noise. She can just very, very sensitively and subtly duck it, because basically the orchestration is going to hide it anyway.
And what we know about the function of the ear is that lower frequency sounds mask out higher frequency sounds. So they'll hide higher frequency sounds. So if you're talking about a background noise that's higher frequency than what you're intending for the audience to hear, the natural function of the ear is actually going to, sounds to me, play a role in how the audience is experiencing that sound.
Yes.
I wanted to get to something else that you've talked about. As we're listening to you, I've heard you say you're wanting the actor to be accommodated with the in-ear monitor. You're wanting the set designers to be able to do what they need to do. And it sounds to me like you are recognizing everybody plays kind of an equally important part, that the sound is no more important than the visual, is no more important than the authenticity of the actor's performance, that it all works together to create the work that you all are looking to achieve. And if one area of the production thinks that what they're doing is more important than another area, it can kind of set that all out of balance. And I'm wondering if you think your perspective on that is part of what's led to your success, that you can come into this knowing you know what you're doing, but also recognizing the other people know what they're doing in their area. So it sounds to me like you have a humble perspective, but a confidence that you know what you need to do to achieve what needs to be done.
Eric, that's a really kind thing to say. And to respond to that, what I can tell you is that on a movie like Wicked, each head of department is at the top of their game, and they've all got there for a reason. And it's not just because they're creatively excellent in their area. It's because they know how to work as a team. And most importantly, they know how to take a step back as a filmmaker and think about what the cinema audience is going to want and how to create a fantastic movie rather than to just prioritize their own craft. And I think that true filmmaking and really, really excellent filmmaking is certainly just it's a team effort. It's a collaboration. And I think that just like the way that the human body works together, you know, it's the way that the heart, the lungs, that, you know, the kidneys and the liver, all, it's no good having one without the other. And it's almost like we all fit into this ecosystem, and we all realize that there is a story to be told. And one thing that we've all got in common on that set, whether it's makeup, costume, sound, camera, production design, the one thing that we've all got in common is that our primary role is to support those original performances that are going to tell the story. And the moment we take our eye off that, or the moment we forget that, that's when potentially the movie that we're making isn't going to be as good as it could be.
And you've brought up a couple of individuals throughout our talk, whether it's choreographer, set designer, director. In the sound production alone, I can imagine there are many individuals involved. And I would think that you each have your own slightly different vision of how you would want a specific scene or number to go. How do you work with collaborating with so many professionals to compromise or get this collective sound you're all happy with?
One of the things that I've tried to do throughout my career, especially since I did my first musical, which was called Copying Beethoven in about 2004, and then my second musical, which was the first Mamma Mia, was when I arrived on musicals, I noticed that there was this weird demarcation between production sound, which is me and my team who work on the set, and post-production sound, who clean up the tracks and mix the tracks in post with music. And then there was another department, and there was a demarcation, and they were the music department. And on my first musical, I asked the question, why? And no one could explain to me. And it was almost like there was this old school traditional outlook that had just been carried across for no particular reason. And so when we came to do Mamma Mia, which was my second musical, I immediately got together with the music supervisor and the post and the sound post-production supervising sound editor. And I said, guys, can we just forget this sound post and production sound and music department? Can we just make it the sound and music department? And what I'm going to ask all of my team to do is to collaborate with your team and to start talking from the very, very beginning about how we all want to integrate our roles to create a better product. And I think that that has really, really helped me, especially in my career in musicals, because it's not something that is normal. It's not the traditional filmmaking method. But what I can tell you on Wicked was a couple of things. The first thing was that myself and Nancy Nugent-Title, one of the supervising sound editors, started talking about Wicked 5 months before we started shooting, which is irregular. I started asking her what I could do to make her life better in post-production. I started explaining to her what my vision is and how I try and deliver and whether that was going to fit with what she wanted. And also, we actually built a recording studios for Greg Wells in Elstree Studios. Greg Wells is obviously our music producer, who mixed all of the instrumental tracks and then later on married the live vocals to them. And we all worked together as a team. We kind of just all took our normal film industry titles, threw them out the window, and just became the Wicked Sound and Music Department. And that just creates something that is, it just means that we're playing everyone's strengths. And it just means that I know exactly what my brothers and sisters in Sound Post need. And I'm talking every day. I'm, you know, on the movie set, me and the music department are just all one department. If you came and you saw the way that we're working on the set, you wouldn't know who was sound and who was music. We just look like one team. That's not always the case. And I think it works extremely well.
As we're talking about the team creating the sound, is there any sort of hidden detail that you all put in, like term Easter eggs, that you all are really proud of that maybe the audience isn't quite dialed into or isn't quite noticing, but you all know, like, wow, we were able to accomplish that, and there's some degree of satisfaction in that? Or is that just kind of getting off on a tangent that's unnecessary within the production?
There wasn't anything, you know, there was nothing hidden. The only thing that I'd say is that when we started Wicked, we weren't sure how much we were going to be able to achieve live. We didn't know how far we could go with it. I had so many crew members saying to me at the beginning of shooting, yeah, we know that you're going live, but how are you going to do Defying Gravity? Because she's flying through the air on a broomstick, and she's going to be on stunt wires. And so it wasn't that people on the crew were nervous about it or thought we weren't going to be able to achieve it. They were just genuinely, they couldn't believe that we were going to try and do that track live. And so I think really our Easter egg was that we did this movie live, and that even songs like Defying Gravity, we didn't turn to a pre-record. You know, Cynthia sung that, I still don't know how, but she sung that as she was on stunt wires doing the most acrobatic tricks that normally on a normal movie set, I can tell you after, you know, my whole career, that actors aren't normally the people doing the somersaults on wires. Now, not only did Cynthia do her own somersaults and acrobatics on wires that were like, you know, gymnast level movements, but she sung live as she was doing those movements. And those vocals made their way into the final mix, and that's what you hear in the cinema. I think that's our Easter egg.
In listening to other discussions you've had about how you create the sound, you've talked about the seeing the vocalist sing and do their work. And let's say in a studio, you could make the sound a perfect 10, but on the set, you can make it a 9.8 or a 9.9. Does the rest of the reality, the seeing the strain on the voice, seeing the muscles move, seeing that action, does that, from your perspective, just elevate the overall viewing experience beyond what that maybe subtle improvement in sound from a studio could achieve?
Such a deep question. And I want to really dive deep into this question. Mm-hmm. As human beings, we have a fight and flight mechanism. And that means that we're all constantly assessing anyone that we interact with to work out whether we trust them or not, particularly with strangers. Mm-hmm. You know, despite the fact that we're in 2024, about to go into 2025, whenever we interact with someone new, it's almost like we're back in hunter-gatherer mode, where we're looking at very, very subtle facial expressions and asking ourselves subconsciously, does that facial expression match the tone of the voice that we're listening to, and working out whether this person wants to be our friend or whether this person is going to be a danger to us. Now, we can't switch that off when we walk into a movie theater to watch a film. That's still there in our subconscious. And I am a great believer that when people walk out of a movie and their friend says, well, what did you think? And they say, yeah, it was okay, but I'm not sure about those performances. That's because their fight or flight mechanism has made them question whether they believe the story that's being told. They're questioning the very essence of the performances on the screen. Now, lots of different things can make them question that. One of them, I believe, is ADR. If we ADR too much in movies, on normal dialogue movies, I think that our audiences can tell that there are tiny differences between the facial expression and the intonation in the vocal. Or it could be that that ADR was recorded in a space that isn't quite acoustically matching the space that we see on the screen in front of us. So let's now take that into the world of live musicals and say that if someone's singing to a pre-record, even if they are singing out loud and their muscles are actually working, but it's the pre-record we're hearing, are we as human beings actually subconsciously trying to check whether, as the actor is walking and singing, whether those tiny little breaths or lip smacks in between the words are the correct and real lip smacks? Or does that quite not match because that was in a recording studio 6 months before we started shooting, with an actor standing still in a vocal booth, and now they're walking along singing, and there's something that alerts us and our fight or flight mechanism that says, I'm not sure I trust that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there is an authenticity and a truth in a real vocal, whether that be a dialogue vocal or a singing vocal. And I think that generally on movies, dialogue isn't re-recorded, thankfully, but I think that the old school version of doing musicals, which is where you get to the end of the dialogue and you, as the audience, you kind of go, whoa, here's the lip sync. And we just accepted the fact that it wasn't real. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. I'm not saying that any of those films didn't work, but we all knew we were watching a film. And I think that we accepted it because that's how musicals were made. And we kind of went, oh, well, this is nice and it's a lovely track and the choreography is great. But I think that when we talk about the way that audiences are connecting with Wicked and they're coming, you know, they're coming out and they're going, wow, what just happened? I cried through that movie. We have to ask ourselves, is that because there was an emotional level connection with the character because we believed those vocals? I believe there was. You know, that's my perspective.
adapting Wicked from the stage show to a movie with a Broadway show or a general stage show, there's just less general belief in the medium as a whole, because you see them acting on stage. Whereas for a movie, I think there's the concept that you are supposed to believe it more from a screen. And so it poses the challenge for you to be able to make it more real than even for a stage show, where you just know that intermission is coming and then they're going to start acting again. And you pulled it off so successfully. I walked out of it believing the vocals. I walked out believing that she was flying and singing at the same time.
Michelle, it's really kind of you to say that, but I've got to just say that John Chu and Alice Brooks, his DP, in every interview that I've heard them do since we finished shooting the movie and while we were shooting the movie, they often speak about the difference between film and stage is that we can go into a close-up and that we can see the actor's emotions far more clearly than even if we're in the front row at the theater watching the stage show. And I think that that ability to get into a head and shoulders close-up and be able to see the emotion on the actor's face and look into their eyes really, really helps us. But what my part of that is to make sure that when we're in that head and shoulders shot and we're looking into the actor's eyes that John and Alice have so skillfully delivered, is that I have supported that with clean enough vocal, whether it be dialogue and or singing, that we don't have to pre-record or re-record, and that when we're watching that fantastic performance, that is Cynthia or Ari's or Jonathan's or Jeff's or Michelle's real performance on the set. And I think that then we have that real truth in what we're watching in the cinema, where we can connect, and it's a marriage of visuals and audio, the whole lot being real.
You know, one last thing that I wanted to touch on, you just mentioned the emotion of sitting through that film. It reminded me of back when I was a student, I interacted there was a patient who was the lowest functioning human that I've ever encountered. And this was a person who couldn't understand the concept of lifting a foot to step up a step. And we're trying to figure out, I'm a kid in my field and with my supervisor trying to figure out, how do we test this person? How do we establish what they can hear? So we put this individual in the booth and we try all different things. Nothing's working. Then we put on children's songs and the person starts bopping in their chair. And my mind was blown, and it solidified for me this idea that music exists across cultures, across continents, across time. It's always been a part of people. And there's just, to me, something innate about it, that somebody who could not conceive of lifting their foot to walk on a step could feel music and could respond to music. And you've talked about the emotional experience of hearing and feeling the songs. For you, when you sit back, you watch this, you know the work and the effort that went into creating this work, this piece of art that you all have been a part of. What is that emotion? What is that feeling when you sit back and just kind of exhale, taking it in?
The first time I started thinking about this really deeply, I always knew it instinctively. You know, I'm an ex-musician and I love music. And, you know, I played guitar throughout my childhood and I still pick up the guitar every now and then. I'm not going to go as far as saying I'm a guitarist, because I'm a pretty poor guitarist, but I love playing it. But instinctively, I knew this. And the first time I started thinking deeply about it was when we were talking about Les Miserables, and Cameron McIntosh said, well, you know, music pulls the heartstrings. And that resonated with me. And I started thinking very, very deeply about what he just said. And of course, he's absolutely right. Music does pull the heartstrings. And what I can tell you is that as a film production sound mixer, I cried when I recorded Anne Hathaway singing I Dreamed a Dream. And in fact, as I speak about it, I get a lump in my throat. I still, you know, that affected me very, very, on a very deep level emotionally, recording that track. I had the same thing when Cynthia, as Elphaba, sung I'm Not That Girl. And then in film number two, which is yet to come out, I had the same experience when Ari and Cynthia sung For Good. And what I can tell you is that if I'm sitting recording a film, I'm watching a 7-inch monitor, I'm not in a movie theater, I'm often just listening a cappella because I like to really, really dig into the vocal. On the first take, I'll listen to a blend of the music and the vocal to check that I've got that blend right. But then what I will generally do is to drop the music right out and just home in on the vocal. And there's something about the human voice that just, even when I'm only watching a seven inch screen in front of me, there's something about listening to a human voice that takes me into another world. And, you know, music is part of that. And the way that we first started creating music before we had any instruments was with our voices. And I think there's something beautiful in that.
Yeah, I wonder if your respect of that feeling is part of what leads to your success, that you recognize when you feel the music, you recognize when it hits you. And if it's hitting you, it's probably hitting other people too. So you've probably landed on something.
It's probably when you know you've got your take exactly right.
Yeah. And here's the thing. It happens sometimes in dialogue, but not as much as when someone's singing. And that's one of the reasons why I love to do musicals, because there's something within the music that resonates with us as human beings. And I think that, you know, there's lots of people that love musicals, and that's why we keep going back. And, you know, again, I think that with Wicked, there's an authenticity to those vocals within the music. I think we get the best of both worlds. Mm-hmm. I think we get that fantastic Wicked score that is just incredible, with those live vocals, with the close-ups where we can see the emotions of the actor when they're singing. And I just think that we've got a triple whammy.
It sure sounds like it.
From what everybody's saying, from personal experience and watching it, it absolutely was the triple whammy. And it makes everybody look forward to what to expect for part two.
Yeah, I think you're really going to enjoy part two. I enjoyed making it.
We're looking forward to it. My last question, as somebody who relies on your ears for your professional work, how do you respect and take care of your hearing?
Well, we spoke about motorcycles earlier. I ride a motorcycle.
Okay,
and
cool.
And I have plugs made that when I went to my plug company, they said, no, what we'd like to do is we'd like to give you plugs which allow, which only reduce 30 dB of the noise. Mm-hmm. And I've actually got complete plugs because I'm so worried about my hearing. Mm-hmm. Because the wind noise on a motorcycle, I know, is a very, very real problem.
Yes.
And so one of the things that I do is regardless of, even if I'm just riding around the corner, you know, doing 3 miles, I put the plugs in. It's an absolute rule for me that I use plugs at all times. The other thing that I do is I make sure that I don't start turning up my monitoring system each year. I try to stay at the same monitoring system that I was at the start of my career. I use the same headphones so that I don't start, you know, every time I buy a new set of headphones, it's the same brand, it's the same model, so that I'm not starting to go, oh, this is a new brand of headphones, I'm going to, you know, turn them up a little bit louder. The other thing that I do is I don't listen to loud music at home. I don't listen to loud music in the car, and I'd stay away from environments that are going to be super noisy. Obviously, my nightclubbing days are long gone. You know, that's something, and I'm very, very pleased when I see that young people are starting to use plugs in nightclubs now. I think that that's really, really important. You know, I've got many friends that from rock concerts or from raves are suffering with hearing loss now. So what I would say to any young people listening is, you know, look after your ears. You're going to need them later. And the kind of places that I avoid now are bars and pubs in the UK where people are having to raise their voices incredibly loud just to have a normal conversation. And so everything has just gone up to volume number 11. And you're having to lean in to hear what the person's saying. That, again, I instinctively feel that that's very destructive for our hearing. Mm-hmm. So that's what I try and do.
And that's the best thing you can do is ear protection, because it's really, in many ways, the only thing we can do to try and preserve our hearing as we experience life. So Simon Hayes, thank you so much for taking your time, having this conversation that for us was fascinating. And we look forward to seeing what comes out with Wicked Part 2 and appreciate all the good work you put out into the world.
Oh, Eric and Michelle, it's so, you know, I've had such a blast talking to you guys. You've asked such wonderful questions, and it's really been lovely doing a deep dive into the actual sonic qualities and the creativity of the human voice with you guys. Such a pleasure to have such a detailed chat. Thank you very much. And I'm so glad you enjoyed the movie.
Oh, it was great. We're gonna want to chat with you after part two comes out.
Okay, cool.
And just so our listeners know, where can they find you on social media? If they want to listen to more of you, where can they find you?
My Instagram account is Simon Hayes Sound. Please come and come and join me there. I like to share lots and lots of my thoughts. And actually, you can go back across my whole career on Simon Hayes Sound Instagram, and the same thing on Facebook, Simon Hayes Sound. Please come and join me there, guys.
Thanks so much. We are grateful for your time.
Thanks, Michelle. Thanks, Eric.